Welcome to our centenary series of podcasts. Our special guest today is Professor Gab Kovacs, International Medical Director of Monash IVF. Thank you for your time, Professor.
Good morning.
I suppose before we start, we should address the baby gammy issue, which is all over the press at the moment.
Right.
What do you make of it? It's a sadder situation, isn't it?
It is such a situation, but we shouldn't be too carried away by it. Surrogacy is a very small part of reproductive technology. It's only a very minority of couples need to use it. And the reason for using it is if the woman has lost her uterus for some reason, or if she can't medically carry a baby. So it is a very rare occurrence. Now, in the state of Victoria, we are now fortunate that surrogacy is legal. But the problem is it's not commercial, so therefore you have to find someone who's prepared to do it for you. I've been associated with two cases of surrogacy, which was really very rewarding and very straightforward. And they were done in Australia. So I guess people going offshore are hiring someone to have a baby for them.
So it's risky.
It is. Well, once you go overseas, you don't play by our rules.
Yeah.
You play by the local rules. And in many places, there are no rules at all. But if you're going to go to America, you're going to go to Thailand, or you're going to go to other countries, you have to realise often it's uncontrolled. The two cases I did were just lovely. One was two girls were at school together. One was 16, hadn't got her periods, went to see the doctors. She was told she didn't have a uterus, couldn't have any children. Her best friend said, "Don't worry, don't cry. When we grow up, I'll have a baby for you."
Lovely.
And they did.
Lovely.
And we had them on the Lindy Byrne Drive show a few years ago,
yeah.
Both the girls. It was just a lovely afternoon. I think everyone had tears in their eyes. It was really nice. The second one I was associated with was a girl who lost her uterus due to cervical cancer at 22.
Mm-hmm.
5-6 years later, she was told she could get pregnant. Fortunately, her ovaries were conserved. We took her eggs, her husband's sperm, and grandma, her mother, the grandma carried the baby, and everyone lived happily ever after.
That's
so there are some good surrogacy stories, and these were obviously both cases where it's necessary now.
And do it at home where the rules are hard
and
fast.
Do it at home if you can, yeah. It's once you're sort of paying people to give you bits of their body, that's got a bad history, hiring people's bodies for money.
On to other things. Last year, you and your colleagues published a case report in the NJA about, it caused a lot of publicity, the first Australian pregnancy after an ovarian cryopreservation and retransplantation. Can you tell us a little bit about the reaction to that case report?
Well, it's just really exciting because it does show that I've been involved with two of those women who've had re-implantations.
Yeah.
The first one worked. Yep. Then she decided that she really didn't want to have a family. It's a woman who had her ovarian tissue taken by somebody else some years before I met her. She came to see me at 47, having found Mr. Right. Unfortunately, Mr. Right didn't have many sperm. That was only not quite right. And she said, look, she'd like me to put the tissue back for her. I said to her, look, I'm happy to try, but I'm off to Europe to a meeting in Venice, and I'm speaking on the same program with a guy from Israel who's had a couple of successes. So why not talk to him first, and when I come back, let's discuss it. And my Israeli colleague was very generous. He sat down, and we got out the envelope that we registered on, and literally on the back of an envelope, he drew me a picture of how he did it, gave me some useful hints about doing it by mini laparotomy rather than doing by laparoscopy.
Yep.
I came back, I did it, and that woman's already started working. By then, she decided she was 47. She felt so good with her own hormones back that she didn't actually... She felt it was all worthwhile, and she decided at 47 she's too old to be a mother, so she didn't pursue. Then Dr. Lynn Burmester approached me. She had a patient who needed a re-implantation, and she'd known that I'd done one, so Lynn did this patient with my assistance.
She's a breast cancer survivor, yes.
She was a breast cancer survivor, 6 years after breast cancer.
Yep.
Very bad breast cancer she had, very extensive. She had to have radiotherapy because she could have surgery, so it was really very extensive in the breast. And Lynn, we did it on Anzac Day, I remember it well, because it was a day when we were both free. So Lynn did it and I assisted her with it, and much to our delight, it started working. She did IVF, she was very lucky, or we were very lucky, because she only had one follicle, we got the one egg, we had one embryo, we put that back, and that gave her a baby. And that was Australia's first and the 22nd in the world.
So healthy baby? Or
healthy baby, all lived happily ever after. The problem is we don't know how successful it is, we don't know what the denominator is. To the best of my knowledge, there are about 28 babies delivered now by this technology.
Yeah.
We don't know how many ovarian tissue have been reimplanted. And we are setting up both a national and international register for this to get the data, but it's going to take some years to get the data. The main thing is it works, and it's yet another option for fertility preservation. And the more options women have, the more likely they are to find something that'll suit their situation.
Is it an expensive option?
Well, this one isn't, because there's no, at the front end, all you have to do is have an operative laparoscopy, cover on Medicare, have the tissue frozen, which is not expensive, mm-hmm. and you have to keep it frozen, which is also not expensive. So it's cheap at the front end. Obviously, when you have it reimplanted, you need to have surgery.
Yeah.
But again, that's covered by Medicare and hospital insurance. If it works, that's great. If you have to go into IVF, then there are the IVF costs. It's certainly much cheaper than the other alternative, and that's cryopreservation of eggs. And I believe it's probably more successful.
You've written for our 1st of September edition a perspective or an editorial, I think, on what's next in IVF. What's the coming hot topic?
Well, I think we kind of started with looking back through a looking glass. And one of the things that is not known around the world is the very first human pregnancy in IVF occurred in Melbourne in 1973. That's been overshadowed by the first births in the UK. Going forwards, I think what I'd like to see IVF be to be more simple. I'd like to see cheaper. I think it's time that we had some economies of scale and mm-hmm. we should be able to be more efficient and offer it cheaper.
Where is the big expense?
Oh, look, everything's expensive now. Yeah. The bureaucracy has grown. The amount of data, the double checking everything has to be electronically checked to make sure there's no mix-ups. Just so much bureaucracy compared to how we started back in the 1970s, I kind of shudder now, but really what we're doing now, it's just an overkill of bureaucracy. So all the costs just multiply, apart from the fact the equipment. For example, now there's time-lapse photography for embryos they develop, and that's the way some of the world's going, and that's like $70,000 for one incubator. And so things are expensive. Mm-hmm. The things, disposables are very expensive. Needles are single use. Clamps are because it's single use. The media we use is expensive. So everything is expensive. The whole thing sort of just bundles up. So we need to look at some smart ways of cutting some of those costs and making more cost efficient. I think that's a challenge for the next decade.
Yeah. What else is a new development? What's happening?
Well, the genetic diagnosis. Mm. That's still a bit of a... It's changing very rapidly, almost monthly. There are new methods of diagnosing chromosomal abnormalities and genetic abnormalities in embryos, and I'm sure that'll grow.
Yeah.
Again, that was pioneered in a lot of the early work was done at Monash, and Leander Wilton then went to the UK and worked with the British group.
Yeah.
So Australia's been at the forefront of that, what's called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. We're now looking at pre-implantation genetic screening, which is look at the normality of chromosomes one step further, and there's various developments. So I'm sure that'll change a lot. I do believe that, well, certainly let's start the most simple case. If both you and your partner carry a genetic disease, recessive disease, you've got 1 in 4 chance of having a child who's affected, then certainly that's something we should screen for. It's readily available, and I think most people around the world believe that's a good thing to do. Next question is then, should we be putting back embryos which carry those bad genes, or should we try and not propagate in the community?
Yeah.
And it's a bit more controversial, because you're discarding embryos who are normal in themselves, but they would pass on the disease.
Right.
And then what else should we screen for? Well, there's now 150 different conditions that can be screened from on your chromosomes, apparently things like Alzheimer's and various other things that don't affect your life initially, but might have long-term effects, or might just affect you some degree. Now, should we be screening those out? It's a difficult question. It's really not a medical question. It's an ethical question. Medically, we can do it. And I remember when Carl Wood started off the team back in the 1970s, he said right at the start, there's many things we can do, but we're happy to be guided by the community and their attitudes about whether we
Does the community give you much guidance these days?
Well, it's a bit hard to know, because it's the ethics committee that decides things.
Yeah.
And that often very much depends on who's on the ethics committee and who's got the strong personality. We all know people who can sway a meeting because they're strong personalities. So I'm not sure the ethics committee is so good. We've also been fortunate that Gary Morgan from Morgan Gallup Pulse has been very helpful to us. And he and I and some of his work have done a number of surveys, including serial surveys on attitudes to IVF, which run over the years. And it gives a better idea of community attitudes, because we are doing a poll of people in the community. And whilst you can't do that about everything, I think it's really interesting.
Are you getting the impression that the community's becoming more liberal about these sort of things?
Well, certainly with IVF. The approval rate for IVF 30 years ago was about 60%. The most recent survey we did was about 2 years ago, which we published, is up in the 90s. 93% of the community approves of IVF for helping people have babies.
What about chromosomal screening, for example?
Well, we haven't survey that. We did survey gender selection. I'm not sure I talk about that because the MJ knocked back the paper. But we did get it published in the Australian New Zealand Journal of Energy.
Okay, cool.
You can cut this out if you like.
That's all right.
Yeah, and it did actually show that only 20% of communities support gender selection, even for family balancing, which is a real surprise to me. And although I've been a great advocate of allowing it to happen, I kind of realised it's a loser and I've stopped putting energy into it. We're not going to change. I mean, it's not worth trying to get the NHMRC to change because the community's not ready yet. Yeah. I think it's a misunderstanding. I don't really think it's a gut feeling. And I've got three daughters. We had this discussion around the dinner table and they were reasonably liberal, as you can imagine, growing up having, since the age of two, hearing about ladies having babies and
yes.
things. So they're pretty well informed, pretty liberal. But they, none of them like the idea of gender selection. So it's interesting. There's a sort of a unease in the community about it. I think it's very much the thin edge of the wedge approach, that if you allow gender selection, well, next we'll be screening for other things and people are not comfortable with sort of genetic engineering. So yeah. I think we'll have to wait. The things that are worth highlighting, Australia leading the world, single embryo transfer. Now, one of the problems of IVF, which we learned a little bit slowly, was that if you have put back multiple embryos, obviously you're going to have multiple pregnancies. Mm-hmm. And we quite didn't quite realise that multiple pregnancy is quite as problematical. Together with the team here, we wrote up 747 sets of twins we delivered over 10 years. And some of them do very well, but there's a lot of problems with twins, and they're not ideal. We also looked at nearly 200 triplets, which Sue Brainy from here presented at the Fertility Society meeting. Again, they have lots of problems. So I believe now that multiple pregnancy is not a good thing to have, and we should be aiming for singleton babies. And the only way you can be sure you're going to have mainly singleton babies is to put just one embryo back. And we've had a real mind change. In Australia now, probably 3/4 of the embryo transfers are single. Okay. It's very different to the rest of the world.
The multiple approach was because you thought then you'd have more chance of having one.
Having a pregnancy. Yeah. Look, if it didn't put multiple embryos back in the early days, we'd never got anywhere. And we started off putting back 3 or 4 even. We only had one set of quads. My set of quads there turned 22 last year. They're 23 this year. They're the only set of quads we ever had. And they've done really well, fortunately. We've had lots of triplets and twins. And I really believe that whilst twins are cute, they've got a lot of reasons why you should avoid them if you can. But even if you put one embryo back, occasionally the embryo splits and you have identical twins, and we can't stop that. But I think that's one of the big breakthroughs Australia has done. We've been at the forefront of the world putting single embryo transfers back. I mean, Australia's been at the forefront of so many things. We can't keep being at the forefront. We've pioneered embryo freezing,
yep.
egg donation, embryo donation, PGD, growing embryos to the blastocyst stage, getting immature eggs out of the ovary and maturing up in vitro. These are all, they were Alan Trounson. I think the person who really needs to be remembered is probably two people, Carl Wood and Alan Trounson, because most of all the things that we did were really Alan's ideas. He brought them from the animal world, and he kept saying, if you can do it in animals, we should be able to do it in humans. We're only, advanced form animal. And Alan predicted all these things would happen, and in fact, most things he predicted happened. And I really think if there's one person in Australia I'd like to credit with making a significant contribution, it was really Alan's contributions. Mean, when you go back and look at it retrospectively, you realise that everything of the new discovery was always Trounson. So Alan's been incredibly outstanding. And now he's gone on to stem cells, obviously, and he's spent the last decade in stem cells. And that's been really disappointing because that's been so slow to be clinically, to be able to apply to clinical situations. And when people talk about stem cells, I say to him, Alan predicted all things in IVF and it all happened. Oh, he's got a good track record. He says it should work in humans with stem cells. I believe it will, but maybe it's going to be a bit longer.
Arvid, talking about reproductive health as a career path for doctors, are there enough reproductive health physicians around?
Well, I mean, I've sort of spent my life doing family planning and infertility and a bit of menopause. And it's just really sad to me that when we have a meeting with experts on particularly contraception, there's a lot of grey hair around the table, and there are very few young people who are really making a career out of academic contraception and reproductive health. So I think there isn't enough people going to reproductive health. No.
Can you put your finger on why that might be?
Oh, look, I mean, part of it's probably it's not as sexy as doing other things is. Maybe it doesn't pay as well. I mean, the big thing in medicine is operating. Quite a lot of articles that surgeons get very well paid, and therefore the surgical specialties are very popular from that point of view.
Yeah.
Then there's things like interventional cardiology, ophthalmology. They're all very attractive, very exciting. And maybe contraception isn't so exciting, and probably it definitely isn't so lucrative. And I think it's just a pity that there aren't young people who've got an academic interest in reproduction.
What would you do to change that if you could?
In the UK, they have the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health, which is a very strong organisation,
mm-hmm.
and it consists both of some specialist ONGs who've gone into it as a sort of subspecialty, and also some women's health GPs who've trained in the specialty. And it's a very strong group, and they have a lot of academic and other interests, and we don't have that in Australia, and maybe should try and promulgate the Faculty of Sexual Reproductive Health through our college here. I'd like to see more young faces at the experts' meetings on contraception and not too many old people like me. Although I would say that I've been terribly lucky that I got into this area, and I've had a fabulous 40 years of working life in contraception, fertility and the menopause, and they've been most rewarding, and I've worked with some fabulous people. And the other thing I guess is really important, it's very much a team effort, that it's not one person. It starts right from the start, from the doctors who see the patients, to the nurses who then administer the treatment, scientists to deal with the embryos, the administrators to make sure that we don't go bankrupt, which we probably would have been in the early days.
Yeah.
So no, I think it's a big team, and we mustn't forget that it's a team, and teams got to work together to get the best success.
Thank you so much for your time today.
It's been my pleasure.